Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
What is grit in fantasy books? He's talking about the dirty physical and the morals, the attention to unpleasant details, the gray characters, and the cynical outlook.
The worst thing a book can be, really, is inoffensive.
So he writes this essay to defend the genre he's writing in.
If you're not okay
that's
with first chapter spoilers.
I love when you
spoilers.
Talk about this book because you actually can't spoil more than
I
chapter
can't,
one.
I literally
because
can't
every
spoil
other time
more.
You say, hey, I'll just spoil the first chapter of this series I read, and you'll be talking about book seven. Unacceptable. Welcome back to another Tutor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
The value of grit.
Grr.
I can't say that well. My voice is a little raspy.
The value of... I'll do it for you.
Thank you.
The value of grit.
That's what I was trying to do.
Get in the back of the throat you've smoking all your life.
Oh, my God. Can we stop, recording and put yourself in the studio? Because you could be a voice actor with that kind of grit. I can't right now. We were on a vacation and I lost my voice. I don't know if I'm slightly sick or if it's raspy vocal cords from yelling.
You yelled a lot on a cruise?
No, I didn't yell that much. It was more so just loud talking. Yeah, I yelled.
I wouldn't know. I was in the room reading a lot. Or on top of the boat in the quiet section reading.
Yeah, you did great reading. Yeah.
It was wonderful. It was my type of vacation. I loved it.
The value of vacations is very high.
I find the irony of talk about the value of grit and going
vacation.
I was on a cruise ship.
I had mimosas. Yay!
That whole vacation was the opposite of grit.
That is correct.
Exact opposite.
The value of grit. What we're talking about today is an essay written by Joe Abercrombie. We will have it in the description below. This is just an essay, so it takes 5-10 minutes to read. It was written in 2013, titled "The Value of Grit." And the reason he wrote this in 2013 is that he saw a tendency of people complaining about the level of grit in fantasy books. And what is grit in fantasy books? He's talking about the dirty physical and the morals, the attention to unpleasant details, the gray characters, and the cynical outlook that the genre is known for. And Joe Abercrombie's writing this because he has what would be classified as a grimdark, and he's called Daddy Grimdark in the fantasy sphere, where he wrote the First Law trilogy. Then beyond that, he has the First Law, many books. There was 9/11,
the Age of
12,
Madness,
something like that. Yeah, but there's the Age of Madness later. There's standalones in there, but he has these grim dark books that focus on the cynical outlook, the more dirt physical, kind of immerse yourself into the grit of things. And this term he titles the essay "The Value of Grit." So we're gonna maybe use grim dark and grit interchangeably throughout this discussion. He uses both terms here. A little factoid, and I believe this is correct. Again, it's kind of hard to find the origin of all words, but the word grimdark likely comes from Warhammer 40,000, where the tagline in Warhammer 40,000 was, "In the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war." That's where the term likely comes from. But essentially what we're talking about is this. It's what Abercrombie's addressing is that dirt physical morality, unpleasant details, a great character, cynical outlook. And he says, hey, he wants to show the value of grit because back in 2013, so we're recording this in 2025, this is 12 years ago now, but he was saying that a lot of people are coming out and saying that they don't see the value in grit. And so he writes this essay to defend the genre he's writing and to say, hey, this is why I think grit has value.
Yep. a lot of this was actually, so my mother watches a lot of these episodes.
Yes.
Huh. And she is not a fan of Grimdark. This essay is for her. This is a response to my mother, basically.
Got it.
So,
what is your stance before reading this? Let's see where we're at of Grimdark and grit in general. Did you see the value in grit before this? Going into this article, what were your preconceived notions?
Yeah, obviously, I like a lot of Grimdark stories as well. To me, it's a valued genre like every other, but often I, you know, have tastes and swings. And I'm going like, to my taste, it's like, there's a lot of Grimdark and a lot of books I've been reading use it poorly. So, yeah, it's a genre that I'm not always interested in, but I see a particular value to it. More specifically in character, I very much like a grim setting or a grim character. I don't often like grim morals in a story as much.
And why is that?
I'm very particular about, like, not characters doing grim things, but like the ultimate theme and story is like just nihilistic or depressing of like, you know, evil wins and that's it. That's just generally a bummer. I often don't read to have a bummed time.
So if it's all for that, yeah.
Yeah, unless it makes me think more, but if I quickly get from the beginning that's the point, that like life is pointless, it's like, okay, so is this book. I won't continue.
Not going to spoil any First Law stuff, but reading First Law, you do enjoy First Law, right?
Yep.
Yeah, very much so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I don't think that about Joe's books.
Yeah, we did review that trilogy on the channel here. You can see all three of them. We can put those in the description below as well. All the way from, oh my God, not Best Curse Sold. What is it called? The Blade Itself was book one. Then all the way to, God, what's that third book called in his trilogy? The Blade Itself is book one.
Mm-hmm.
Book two. Oh wow, it's in there deep in my gritty bones. What the hell? Last Argument of Kings. Got it.
You get
okay,
there.
I was getting there someday, but we reviewed that, and you could check that out on the channel. So we're coming in there having read those three books. I've also read The Devils, his most recent book. You've read also Best of Cold, and another one or two of his books. Right?
Nope. Just that.
Okay, so we're similar playing field. But yes, so Grimdark and gritness in general, I'm coming in with the notions of, before reading the Value of Grit, this essay, I had the idea of Grimdark as in similar to you, I see the value in almost all things. I see value in a lot of different literary forms
a wide range of emotions. A wide spectrum of genres have value. Yeah,
exactly. And I think they can all get this wrong, and Grimdark, grit can get this wrong, just like anything else can, which he addresses later in this essay. But I'm coming in here where it's excessive or gratuitous for gratuitous sake of like if the gritness is just there for pure shock value, just to go, feel this. If it's just there for that kind of what could be pointlessness, again, what's one person's pointlessness is another person's point. That's where the line's kind of fuzzy. Again, it gets addressed later, but that's my thing of I'm totally here for grit when it feels like the story needs to have that. And in Abercrombie's First Law, especially Billy itself, I you see that he has a story to tell. And although by the end of the trilogy, I didn't like it as much, I was disappointed by the end. So that's where I'm coming in with. I see value, but there's a line somewhere that's harder to define. And I think our thoughts will form more as we discuss this and find out where that line is. Because he does a really good job in this article of defending all the points and value of grit. And so it'll spark a lot of conversation. I really enjoyed reading this.
I did too. So let's get into it.
So he says, we'll quote at the beginning here, of him talking about this grimdarkness. He says, "Grimdark is a phrase I'm hearing quite a lot, which seems by definition to be pejorative. excessively and unnecessarily dark, cynical, violent, brutal, without purpose, and beyond the point of ridiculousness. There's often what seems to me a slightly weird double standard applied of, I find this thoroughly horrible and disgusting, therefore the author must have intended me to be titillated and entertained. Of course, there's always been those who'd rather not have explicit sex, violence, or swearing in their books and express that as an entirely reasonable matter of taste, but there are others who go well beyond taste and identify grit as something objectively dangerous, wrong, or reprehensible. So this is the main thing that Abercrombie's saying in this article. He's talking against those who see grit as objectively dangerous, wrong, and reprehensible. Those things specifically. And maybe your mom or other readers out there are seeing that case, which I sympathize.
She would be fairly strong. That's her camp. Yes.
I can see that. And I'm going to, my opinion will be, I mostly agree with Joe, but I also disagree in parts too. So there's things
I'm not in that camp, mm-hmm. but I do see significantly less value in a story that relishes in the grim, relishes in the gratuitous violence, cynical nature for basically shock value or just a titillating sake. I think there is something more wrong with that than maybe its counterpart opposite. Gotcha. Of something being hopeful for just hopeful sake and doesn't say too much beyond it. I think that's just generally better than the opposite, but yeah, we'll get into it.
Well, we will get into that. So that's the premise of this. And again, he's saying that people see this as low grade moral slime. And now he starts and he goes, all right, let me just caveat this. So Joe Abercrombie says, let me give a caveat. He says, I quote, this is what he says, I don't think everything has to be gritty by any means. In fact, there's a degree to which grit loses its power the more of it there is. Every writer has to find their own style, their own way to be truthful, and with great grit comes great responsibility. That's the caveat he puts, which
is the thing I agree with probably the most. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of grimdark books out there where they kind of start off right at the gate of this is super grim, dark, all this, and to the point where I don't care anymore. Of like, the shock value's gone. Like, you, page one, the shock was there. Like, but then you don't get attached to the characters. And when the characters die, I'm like, good. They sucked. They're terrible. They're terrible people that all deserve to die. And so I don't care anymore. Or, oh, wow, isn't it shocking that this big, important death happened? It's like, no, it isn't. Of course they died. It becomes too much and it's not shocking anymore, and that's kind of the point of if it's grim for the shock value, it quickly loses its allure and its advantage.
In one of his defenses, he talks specifically about shock value, and I like how he addresses it. He addresses those complaints in this too. And a quick pause right before we continue with our sponsor, Into the AM. If you want some sweet graphic tees that are a little bit gritty at times too, go check out Into the AM, our link in the description, intotheam.com/ramble, using our code ramble at checkout for 10% off of these sick graphic tees. They got fantasy, sci-fi stuff, space stuff, ship stuff. What I'm wearing, I've got a moon in a very nature setting. What do you got on, Rich?
I got like a little Japanese-inspired dragon and towers and samurai ninjas and all that. But they also have pants, other types of shirts, polos, all the good stuff, and actually good quality shirts.
Very good quality.
So check them out if you want to get a cool shirt and also support us. We really appreciate it.
Again, that's code RAMBLE for 10% off. Check the link in the description below to support them, support us. Thank you so much, Into the AM, for sponsoring this episode.
Now back to the video.
Thank you, Into the AM. Remember, check description below. Thank you for supporting us. All right, we've got... Now, the bulk of the article, he says this, which I this is a big question I have for you. I like how he put this a lot. Okay. I like how he put this. He says, I believe the role of a writer is not to avoid offense. Do you agree? He says, I believe the role of a writer is not to avoid offense.
Yes. 100%. Mm-hmm. If you won't risk offending anybody, you're going to say nothing. And that's the worst thing a book can be, really, is inoffensive, in my opinion. Like, you know, talking about the reason why you talk about the weather in the elevator is basically to avoid any kind of offensive conversation. You just want to get through it. You don't actually want to say anything of substance. That's the point of talking about the weather. But you go into the elevator and you just go like, so what's your stance on the divinity? Do you think there's one God or many? Or ultimately, do you think it's right for, you know, the faithful to take the sword to the unfaithful? That's how you should start elevator conversations.
I thought you were going a different direction of like, no, walk in the elevator, insert group of people here are taking my insert job. And like walk in just...
insert group is taking insert thing or place.
And then that's how
and
you
then
should strike
we
a conversation.
Should do insert terrible thing to them. Yes, yes. That's how you should start every conversation.
We should insert terrible things into insert them. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also unoffensive things. So Pixar movies and stuff that will also be as fulfilling as well. Messages of family and love, etc. But these offensive things, why I like how he's put this, of I believe the role of a writer is not to avoid offense, made me think of comedians a lot. Mm-hmm. Of the role of a comedian, of many comedians, of course, people that there's comics that work, humor is very subjective, but comedians not avoiding offense is a style of humor to kind of talk at some sort of truth that's there, of touching on something that connects with human, not every human, of course, but a subsect of truth. Because if somebody's laughing, if somebody sees some sort of value in that really dark humor, that grotesque, whatever the humor might be, does it have inherent value then? And that's a lot of the question that he poses here of when he's talking about grit, of not avoiding offense. If somebody doesn't like sex in your face, grit in your face, and we have our own personal opinions on that, but we'll get into, but that it's a good point he makes. And he continues on by saying this: the role of the writer is also to throw caution to the wind and write the most honest and heartfelt book you can. Better to have a book that many readers love and some find revolting than a book that no one reads at all. Do you agree with that?
It's the very true adage of, you know, if you try to please everyone, you'll please no one. And so find your audience. It's a reason why there's so many different genres, and that it is difficult when we rate things in genres that I'm not well versed in, or at least maybe I'm not interested in. It's something of trying to determine whether it is just my taste or it is an actual question of quality, and judging a genre by one book. It's difficult, but it's the same thing. Same concept.
Yeah, making this point about writing the most honest and heartfelt books you can, I think Abercrombie would agree with this statement of that is when I don't like, again, all genres, but grimdark, as we're talking about this, that when I don't like grit is when it doesn't feel honest and heartfelt, and where it does feel grit for grit's sake. Mm-hmm. In the same way I'd feel about anything, that it just seems like you're doing the thing because you're writing it at someone and not you're writing it for yourself. Kind of a weird way to put it. Or maybe just like you ever hear the advice that Pierce Brown recently made, this advice of write the book that you'd want to read, not that somebody wants to read, like you're marketing and trying to write something for the, ooh, this trope and this genre is doing well, so let me kind of make this writing into just more marketing rather than writing something you genuinely have your heart and soul into. And that maybe that's where it feels wrong sometimes, where you feel something's gratuitous or just excessive grit, which he made that caveat of, hey, don't just do grit for grit's sake.
There,
be honest and heartfelt with it.
There's a point to it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, I'm in agreement with him there.
So the value of grit, first he talks about realism before getting into his list of what encompasses grit. He talks about realism.
Well, ultimately being the double standard being applied of, on one hand, it's like grimdark is held to a level of like, oh, it's not realistic. It's like, yeah, it's fantasy. You don't say, you know, what is the actual, like, maybe more hopeful story is not particularly even more realistic. But then he follows that on like, okay, I think it's held to a double standard, but also life is gritty. There's a lot, like if you just pick up a history book, life can suck a lot of times, and a lot of bad things happen to really good people. Things happen for no reason. Like, a big reason of catharsis in stories is because real life doesn't, more often than not, have an actual ending. There is no, you know, nice little bow at the end. Sometimes a random thing happens and there's no plot reason for it. And that's why stories can be so cathartic sometimes, because it makes life ordered and like wrapped in a little bow. But Grimdark, it takes that opposite approach of like, maybe it is more realistic because a random thing happens. It's like, that wasn't alluded to in the plot.
Like, I was in an elevator and someone just started cursing at this insert group here. I was just sitting there, yeah. And then two podcasters just started. And that could just happen randomly.
Yeah.
And yeah,
that doesn't need to be a plot reason for it.
No, it just, they thought it was stupid. Yeah. So him saying that both the people who say it's realistic and the people that say unrealistic, both are right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the part about grit that I am in nature just an optimist. I prefer other types of stories, probably more so. I don't mind Grimdark at all, especially Grimdark done very well. But yeah, that's my preferences. But at the same time, it's just because my more outlook on life and experiences and just what your tastes are can lead that way. Because you know, if you go through a park and you had a bad day versus a good day, if you go through a park, you're seeing the sun shining and the dogs walking and barking and people laughing and you're seeing couples talking and it's all feeling good. But you could also walk through that same park and see the dog shitting and you could see the leaves falling and they're kind of dying because it's fall time. Instead of that being pretty, they're like crumpling to dirt. And you can see instead of people laughing, you're not seeing an argument over there. And the sun's kind of falling. It's getting more dark. It's the same park, but how are you? What's your perspective of it? And a lot of what grit is it's a truth of life. It's not the truth, just like nothing. It's a perspective as you're walking through that park. And I think that's what a lot of grit and grimdark is. It's just narrowing into that thing, which even me as a person, as a reader, I don't like to focus on. I do see the value and like to read that sometimes or just hear that perspective. But it's just, it's a truth. It's just another aspect of life. And how much do you want to focus on it? You choose. Do you agree with that generally?
Yeah. It's generally, I'm also relatively optimistic about life. Shocker. I'm not a complete bummer in real life, but.
You said that so unconvincingly. I'm not a complete bummer. Like you had to add complete. You just had to add a little
caveat. But no, it's the same thing. Often there are really grim realities, but at least in my experience, a lot of people's realities are a lot less grim than their perception of it is, and that their perception of the world actually puts themselves in a worse place than if they just had a slightly more positive attitude or gratitude for their. For the good things in their life. But that's personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Pure Nessie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, I love that book.
he says, I'll quote this. Critics might say that grit is so prevalent now, or so prevalent, we now can be sure our hero will be eating babies by the end of the prologue. But I actually don't believe that, says Joe Abercrombie. What do you think about what he's saying critics are saying? That grit's so prevalent, aren't they just going to eat babies by the prologue? I mean, grit is such... And this he's talking about this in 2013 of grit is such a big thing. Is it just going to be all right in your face, the worst thing you could imagine? Let's write that.
I mean, it's certainly sometimes true, but I don't think that's the stuff that really gains traction. It's not the type of literature that gains mainstream attention and notoriety. So he is right about that. Now, a book that I haven't finished, and so I actually don't know, but that exact situation was my perception. Prince of Thorns, mm-hmm. by Mark Lawrence. I don't think I'm really giving spoilers away of this being... I've literally only read the first chapter. If you're not okay
that's
with first chapter spoilers...
I love when
spoilers.
You talk about this book because you actually can't spoil more than
I
chapter
can't,
one.
I literally
because
can't
every
spoil
other time
more.
You say, hey, I'll just spoil the first chapter of this series I read and you'll be talking about book seven. Unacceptable. Go ahead. You're
I
allowed.
Literally can't. You're, so, spoiler warning for the first chapter of Prince of Thorns.
I'm out of here.
you have this character who is this young boy leader of this gang. And you think, oh, is this one of those like fantasy gangs, maybe rapscallions, like a little grim, little dark, little gray around the edges? No. Goes into a village and basically instructs and tells his compatriots to, you know, rape these two village girls over there that they were caught hiding. He finds them and then has his gang buddies rape them. And then as he's, you know, taking all the money from the father and basically forces him to watch, then he takes his turn with the women and ultimately then forgets them, then kills the father as well. And then goes off on their merry way. And it's like, oh, well, I did the father a favor. And by the end, I'm going, this is our main character. I want him to die. I refuse to read a whole book of this character. I'm not going to do it. I don't have to. No one's forcing me. So, like, that is kind of the extreme.
You know, like,
of, like, from chapter one of, like, yeah, your main character's, like, I mean, they didn't eat babies, but morally speaking, it's, like,
pretty close.
Yeah. Pretty up there.
Yeah, it's that grim fascination society has with killers and evil of the Ted Bundys, and people having entire docuseries about these horrific killers and events, and almost like watching a car crash too. This fascination with seeing that side, because again, it is there are those types of people that evil does exist.
It's just I personally don't see the appeal of living that reality in a story, because that's when I'm reading a book, I want to live that reality. It brings it alive. I don't want that to be alive in my head for an enjoyment, but that's a personal
preference. Yeah. Yeah. Do you see the value in it?
Here's the thing. Mark Lawrence is a great writer. I really love his series, Book of the Ancestor. Like, fantastic fantasy series. He's a great writer. I imagine that he didn't write that book for, like, Prince of Thorns, grit for grit's sake, and that's it. I imagine there is a real point. There is something of real substance to say that only that type of gritty story could tell.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know it, and I wasn't willing to read on.
Got it.
So I wasn't willing to find out. I'm sure there was a point, but kicked me out. And you know what? In many ways, maybe that's actually the right thing. You know, Mark had a particular story he wanted to tell, and he filtered those people out in chapter one. Of like, hey, look, this is what the story is. If you're not good here,
that's what he's promising, yeah,
you know, bow out now, because how bummed would you be if he drew you in a little bit more, and then like halfway through the book, then that stuff starts happening. You're like, I was not promised this. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad he let me DNF chapter one.
He's told you, hey, this is not for you right away.
Yeah.
Now, in the article here, Abercrombie lists seven aspects of grit, of grimdark, of why it is valuable. And the very first one, he says, is tight focus on character. That's his first argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's specifically going into like the fight scenes and like the gritty realities of life, instead of having a more omniscient point of view, telling the story from high above and not really getting deep into the thoughts of a character. You know, if you're all the way down tightly focused into a character, you're going to see maybe not so kind thoughts, because people have very awkward, violent, or depraved thoughts. It's things they won't even speak out loud, but they have it in their head. Everyone knows, like, intrusive thoughts, or the fight scenes that are, how else do you tell a great fight scene without the details and feeling like you're there? Because there is blood, there is gore, there is all these dark things and, gritty things in a fight scene. How do you tell a good one without showing that?
Yeah, the epic fantasies where he said focused more on setting and world and macro scope, big picture, and then the grit, focusing with a magnifying glass instead of just pointing and moving armies on a battlefield of sending these thousands of troops over here. War can kind of have this glamour and hope and this prestige to it and feeling of vigor, like, oh, look, battle, warriors, let's go. And you could feel that kind of a weird catharsis in a way, because war has this, can have this allure to it. If I'm going to go off to war, fight for it. What's the very popular, Western Front, All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yes.
Book, many movies made at this point. The recent movie made was fantastic, by the way. Really great movie. But those kind of even movies like that, zooming in on the character, not just, hey, this army's fighting this army, but look at this soldier who's fighting in the battle, and it can show you and then can have a message about how war's horrible and war's bad. War's not so bad when you're just looking at numbers on a page of, okay, X number died, X number casualties. When you see that one casualty and one that one soldier and what they have to go through, then you start to, that's where empathy comes from. Empathy doesn't come from just macro thinking about concept in general. Empathy comes from, no, I'm going to give you a specific anecdote, specific story that makes you care and makes you realize. Because even right now, how many people are just dying across the world, you won't give it a second thought. If you read in a news story without much details of, hey, person died, child in said country, or this number died from this explosion, it's hard to cry over that. It's difficult because the story, the empathy, when you start to hear more about, oh, the person that died, that was, the more details you get and the more the things you can connect with and understand as a human, you start to feel that. And that's where Grit has this tight focus on character, that advantage of showing you that and narrowing can build empathy in that way. So I thought it was a great first point you made.
Yeah, no, it's certainly an advantage that generally, like, a gritty story will often be hyper-focused and you'll be right into the character's mind. Like, you'll often get that. So I get his point. I don't think it's necessarily always true. I think you can have a hopeful story and also be tightly focused on the character.
For sure.
Because I don't think grit and adversity are exactly the same. You can have a very hopeful story with, you know, real adversity, challenge, and all the things that Joe is attributing to grit. Like, grit gives you the dirty realities, the, you know, temptation toward evil, all these, you know, gritty things. You can also have those kind of stuff in a hopeful story. It's just, where does it go afterward? What direction does it go? So,
can war be not gritty?
Depending on your perspective. Basically means everyone that's playing Hearts of Iron, just a bunch of little monsters. we're raising the next generation of monsters playing that game. No, but there's oftentimes can be something noble about war, and even in zoomed in. So, like, you can have the, you know, large out, you know, zoomed out perspective of war being, you know, hey, we're fighting this great evil. It is good to, you know, it's good versus evil. You can have all these things. You zoom out on the big battle scenes. But I think you can also have a noble thing to see in war of, like, it zoomed in on a single character, of a character trying to protect their brothers in arms, and self-sacrifice. All of these things that maybe, it is sad, but it can be very noble and good, heroic even. So those are also aspects of
war. Is heroic and gritty antonyms for you?
Often. Yeah. I think they kind of go hand in hand. Maybe Joe wouldn't agree.
Mm.
But yeah, often when I hear grim, dark, gritty, it's that there are no heroes. There isn't, like, if you aren't self-interested, like, those are the first people to die. And there is no, like, nobility or hope is fruitless. Like, that's the vibe I'm getting here, where sometimes that is there, but the other doesn't necessarily have to be true. It doesn't mean that a story with a lot of gruesome details can't also be hopeful or noble, heroic.
I think on this one, the tight focus on characters, he's probably thinking about the attention to physical details. Like, you know, when you see his writing, it's the blood, sweat, spit, sex, those kind of punchy, in your face, the sweat and grossness and disgust and all of that of war. That's just
the actual description details. Yeah.
That tight focus. And he's also probably touching on what did he say earlier too? Yeah, the dirty physical stuff, that the unpleasant details. That seems to be what he's focusing on. It's the unpleasant details of war, which, you know, that nobility or that kind of aspect of narrowing in on a character and seeing this battle scene as more noble. And maybe if you're using that as an antonym, would you be saying that instead of focusing on, you know, the blood and tears and sweat and piss on that person, he's more focused on saving this person's life and not describing that, but the attention of detail is on the hope and the attention of detail is on sacrifice and that kind of difference. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. I think if your focus and attention is on how they piss themselves while they're in the middle of a battlefield and just you get all to the details, I think it can sometimes distract you from maybe what their action actually is doing. What are they doing it for? And often I just find those to be mutually exclusive.
It
doesn't always have to be. That's not a rule. It just seems to be the tendency. Am I off base there? Do you know plenty of stories? Do you see it where it shows all the gritty details of a battle, but also shows maybe self-sacrifice and heroics?
One that comes to mind is Hacksaw Ridge. Have you seen that movie?
Sure.
That's where it's the soldier, a lovely movie, by the way. It's a soldier, Andrew Garfield plays it, where he refuses to bring arms for religious purposes. He refuses to bring weapons refuses to carry a gun.
Yeah.
Into battle. So, but he'll go into battle and save his fellow comrades. He'll save his battalion, his fellow soldiers. And he'll go into battles and like you see the grittiness of war. Like it's in your face, but he's also saving people. Something like that, maybe.
Sure. Yeah. It doesn't always have to be. It's just when reading, that seems to be the tendency that I see.
Gotcha. Yeah. Do you see the tight focus on character? Is that always an aspect of grit and of grimdarkness, of it seems to have a tight focus on character? Because this is his first point of that the value of grit. His point here is tight focus on character. That is the title of number one. Would you agree with that part?
Again, it can be.
Can be.
Joe does a great caveat of like, there's, you know, grim dark done for, you know, just grim's sake rather than actually for a real point or a real message or, you know, any authenticity. Yeah, it comes across as silly and hokey. The same thing with a more hopeful story being, you know, the power of friendship. And they just do it because that's kind of the point. There's not really any deeper meaning beyond it. It's not truthful. It's not authentic. Can come across as silly and trite in both cases. Gotcha. So, yes, in the best case scenario, Grimdark will focus on the characters.
Got it. From reading Joe Abercrombie, my favorite part of his books that were the characters. Not the one I got further in the series, less so like on the on the more thought-provoking stuff and the plot and that. But what he did very well was tight focus on character and getting in the head of these, which gets into point number two, moral ambiguity. Yep. So another value of grit for him is moral ambiguity. And how he starts this off, he defends it by saying, instead of that World War II and Cold Era feeling of there's a good versus evil, of there's the Axis and there's the Allies, there's the Soviet Union versus the U.S., instead of having this Western idea of, hey, there's good and evil, he's putting more moral ambiguity on it now, especially with, I'll quote him, he says this here, in real life, you don't have orcs that you can conveniently tell are going to be evil by looking at their spiky armor and can therefore, in good conscience, slaughter without mercy. You have different groups of people with their infinitely complex individual needs and conflicting desires.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that, for his moral ambiguity being an advantage of a value of grit?
I think I see value in both types of stories. Like, yeah, the real world is morally ambiguous. There very often isn't good guys, bad guys, if you think of a global scale. But very often on a micro scale, there is good guys, bad guys. Bad guys are the people threatening you and your family. That's basically it. And so to say, like, there are no bad guys, there's no good guys, it's depending on your view and perspective, which is moral ambiguity, I understand. But the whole point of orcs is it's not supposed to be taken really as like, oh yeah, apply this same, say like there are insert group of people are orcs and therefore can be wiped out indiscriminately, is a representation or an analogy for evil, great evil, corruption, all the stuff of like which should be resisted and all that stuff. So both have their value. To me, it's more of a matter of taste at this point. The amount of moral ambiguity in the stories is kind of getting annoying. And I'm like, hey, yeah, I've read this a lot. I kind of want to read, you know, I want the evil guy to actually just be evil and not misunderstood. I'm done. I've had enough. Give me some other stuff here. I can go back and forth. I can have both. That's where I'm at.
Do you see value in both?
I see value in both. It's more of, like, I think today in most popular culture, like popular media, I'm a little tired of the misunderstood villain. It's annoying at this point. And here's the real problem when I find it is taking moral ambiguity to the point where not that I'm just supposed to be sympathetic for the villain, but I'm supposed to root for them. Of like they are justified in what like the trying to get the wrong point and wrong message out of it of, you know, this bad, you know, this person does very bad things for sympathetic reasons. Fine. But also that doesn't justify them doing very awful things. Just because someone suffered a terrible childhood does not justify them, you know, hurting others in the future. Like I'm still gonna judge them, like I'm not gonna let them go. It's like, oh well, you had a terrible childhood. There, buddy. No, I'm going to like, really sucks, but you hurt a lot of people. So, no. Your suffering does not justify the continued suffering of others. That's where I don't like the moral ambiguity stuff.
The Joker was not correct.
Yeah. Joker, like, you're not supposed to go like, the Joker's actually right. No, he's not. And then the second movie goes too far of like.
Now I these are some that I don't like, but the like Taxi Driver of the film too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could be described as gritty. That the message of it isn't necessarily like, I mean, hey, people get the wrong message of do what John Hinckley did, right? People get the wrong message of ooh, Taxi Driver that's emboldening.
Yeah.
The character,
the one
Travis,
that I see, the one I see the most of is American Psycho.
I haven't seen it. Don't spoil too much for me. I still haven't seen American Psycho.
Have you seen the poster?
Yeah.
Where Patrick Bateman or, you know, the main actor, mm-hmm. Christian Bale, has a lot of blood on his face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know he's not a good guy.
Oh, that spoiled it.
I know. Oh, shocker.
You just shocked me.
Guess what? Through memes, people aspire to that. And go like, gotcha. Patrick Bateman, basically. Seeing the positive qualities, it's like, you're not supposed, like, he's still the psycho. He's still the American Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
Not supposed to see that,
he does touch on this later. Joe Abercrombie touches on this later about probably addressing a lot of the complaints here of you saying, yeah, get more ambiguity, but you also like your more defined and, hey, there is good and there is evil.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Again, the value, when he's describing the value of grit here, does more ambiguity do something, you know, touches on something valuable that those stories don't. Because the good versus evil can't touch on, if it's pure good and evil, they don't really touch on the moral ambiguity. Is there value to having more morally ambiguous characters, gray characters?
Moral ambiguity does, the point of it is to get you to question your morals and like something that maybe you have a strong belief in or something you haven't clearly thought about and you go, oh, actually this thing is not really as clear cut as maybe I thought, and makes you consider, it is thoughtful. Where I think that goes wrong is like moral ambiguity works in some cases, and in other cases I don't care. It's like, murder. Is murder being like trying to make that morally ambiguous, like murder of children? No, it's not ambiguous to me. And trying to make it so just throws up red flags in my head. I'm going, why am I reading this? This you're trying to make this morally ambiguous, and it isn't. And I don't see much point in that.
So is it more so on bad grits and bad moral ambiguity? Is like when you go, maybe there's more offense taken for you when there's a poor grimdark. Or if you fail at being gritty, that's worse than if you fail at being noble.
Probably. To some degree, like even a clumsy attempt at a noble story, at least, like, to me, it's like, yeah, it's inoffensive, which again is, I guess, the top of the point is like, yeah, inoffensive is the worst thing that could be, rather than try to say something real and offend a lot of people. So I get that.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
But to me, like in a personal subjective opinion, if you're trying to make a very clear moral wrong, morally ambiguous, I'm not really on board. And if it's done even sloppily, like I'm even more so. So, yeah.
Yeah, I follow. I think I understand. So when he's getting at that, the more and more ambiguity we have, and he's talking at this time 2013, mm-hmm. Now it's 2025. So he's addressing the same stuff you're saying 12 years ago. Does it shock you that even, I guess, in the past over a decade, that this is still something that's in the conversation? You're saying there's still too much grit or grimdark for your liking.
There still is, but I think I can see the pendulum shifting away from it.
Which he also addressed, yeah.
Yeah, he does address at the end there. And mm-hmm. I'm personally glad to see it. I want the pendulum to shift a little bit, and we could have both types of stories, but yeah, just making things gritty for gritty's sake, like, it's valuable because it's dark, and it's like, ooh, Superman kills somebody. Like,
I do think, too, it's interesting, there's so many books out there and so many popular series, you can get grit, gritty, noble, bright, whatever they call it now, but you can get all of that, and it's all coming out today. It's just, yeah, grit, grimdark is popular as a subgenre, but there's plenty of, I mean, look at Stormlight and how successful that is. And that was 2010 and onwards. And basically all of Sanderson's stuff,
yeah,
is none of it's grimdark.
Yeah.
Can't think of one. Yeah. But there's plenty of stories you can get. And the interesting thing he says a little bit later on, we'll go in order still, but he talks about this a little bit later, saying how George R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire and that having grimdark grit aspects to it. It's fascinating to me because when I look at Song of Ice and Fire, the book specifically, Game of Thrones, it gets a little gritty, but it's not as grimdark as you'd expect. It's really not that. So people knowing the basic thing about Game of Thrones, the Song of Ice and Fire, like, I won't spoil much just in case, but there is a clear good side and bad side. There are moral ambiguous, there's characters in between that weave and there's grayness, but there's a clear side you should be rooting for and a side you shouldn't be. So there is good and evil, but there are the aspects, of course, of kind of getting a little gritty here and there, but it really, it was written in the 90s, so Game of Thrones was written in the 90s, but it just shows you how much the genre, how much it influenced the genre as well and what happened when I look back on Game of Thrones and the Song of Ice and Fire and go like, oh, that seemed like more of a transition period of, yes, it wasn't Tolkien, it wasn't Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It was its new thing, but also it didn't just ignore Tolkien. It built off of him and did this twist that with a big thing that happens in book one, you go, oh my God, that can happen in stories. And that he talked about this a little bit later, which we'll get into. But yeah, that's something that surprised me.
The direction that I really like when Grimdark does is where you try to understand evil. You understand darkness rather than try to justify it.
Mm.
And Game of Thrones does a great job of characters' evil actions are not really justified. And like, oh, they were, you know, right to do so. It's more of like, oh, I get, it's still wrong. It's still evil. But you understand why. And so it gives a little bit of sympathy, but doesn't try to justify a lot of evil stuff that goes on, which I think is the best area for Grimdark. And I think the mistake that someone that does maybe Grimdark poorly trying to justify evil.
Yeah,
that's where my hackles kind of raise. I'm like, understanding is fine. And I think that's what, you know, Taxi Driver, American Psycho, a bunch of these different stories. It's done best when it's understood. You're trying to understand the darkness rather than like empathize or not empathize, but like try to justify it.
Yeah, the ends don't justify the means. They explain the means. They go like, yeah. Okay, I see why a psycho functions like this.
I think Joe does a great job in his writing of it's not trying to make characters that do awful things and then trying to justify them. It's characters that do awful things. And yeah, they're characters that they did awful things and probably deserve punishment for. He doesn't shy away from them being actually bad and doesn't often try to justify it.
Would you say he writes honestly?
Yeah.
That's point three. Point three is honesty.
Yep.
Would you say he works honestly?
I think so.
You think he doesn't, it's not justifying, hey, look, because this happened to Glock, won't get into spoilers and stuff. But yeah. Honesty. What do you think that as his point?
Well, his point here is mainly just people crap, people swear, people get ill, people die in a way that serves no narrative, people get drunk and take drugs, people really do and think and say vile things, people are horrible to each other, really horrible. And he goes on, like, just honesty that people are like this. And, yeah, true. It's an aspect, but not everyone is like that. So, that's why I'm just being mired down in a series that everyone is like that feels unrealistic to me and less honest in all honesty. It is a perspective, but I at least just don't see it that way. Not everyone is a piece of shit. Some people actually are pretty decent. Like, there's a lot of decent people out there, surprisingly enough.
Yeah, is this the natural tendency? Because that park analogy of, you know, if I'm walking through a park, I'm generally viewing life in a certain kind of lens. Hey, what happened in your day? You might, Grit and Grim might be more honest to you on a different day as well. Because what if you're a parent passes, a grandparent, or someone close to you passes away, you lose your job, a bunch of bad shit happens to you in a row. I don't think you're going to go out and smell the roses that day. I don't think you're going to go around and be skipping with joy of, I'm an optimist. But instead, you're going to be probably viewing the world with shit-tainted glasses. You're not going to be walking around super joyful. And yeah, I go to stories, not a flight of the deserter, but an escape of the prisoner. I go to stories to escape the world and learn and immerse myself and also apply that to the real world. And that's a large part why I read stories. I also, there's a bunch of reasons. That's one of them. But when I go to stories, I'll gravitate toward things that are more like bittersweet's my favorite kind of ending. Mm-hmm. I like something bittersweet. I like something that I could take away and apply it, all sorts of things. But point being, the honesty, I don't think he's making this. At no point is he making the argument that epic fantasy or hopeful or noble, right, that doesn't have a place and isn't valuable. I think that, and this is coming from somebody who by the end of First Law was kind of disappointed, but again, really enjoyed the characters. He's not saying that noble, bright, and all those genres aren't valuable. Like, he says those are valuable, and also, look, honesty in the Grit form, it's just, it is a part of the world that is honest. Of this, there is a value to to showing and explaining the darkness that's out there at times, and just going, hey, that is something that is real. It exists. And if you want to, if you read chapter one of Prince of Thorns and you're not feeling that, that's totally okay.
It's okay to DNF that. I'm definitely not against it because it's not honest.
Yeah.
I do understand that those kind of people exist.
Yeah.
I am aware.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to read it.
How much did you?
That's not my form of escape.
How much do you like Jake Spoon?
Oh,
and Jake God, Spoon is a dargone dissonant fellow.
I love Jake Spoon. Jake Spoon is a great character. God, I love Lonesome Dove.
But Jake
Lonesome Dove is Jake's, a gritty book.
It is, and Jake Spoon isn't really your knight in shining armor.
No, it's. But seeing that's the right way is again the reason why I like Grimdark is understanding rather than justifying. Like Jake Spoon is bad. You're not supposed to sympathize with the bad character.
Is Jake Spoon honest? Is that an honest character?
It is an honest character.
That's his point.
Yeah.
Of those Jake Spoons out there, when grit is done right, it feels honest. Explains that. Yeah, where it gets wrong, I do agree on this. If everyone is
Jake Spoon, you go, is that really that honest? Like, not everyone's Jake Spoon. By the way, we're referencing a character from Lonesome Dove. I'm giving nothing other than, like, Jake Spoon is not the best. So, if that's a spoiler, I don't think that's much, but whatever.
But with a character like that, I'm with you on the extreme of if you justify the moral bad, it's worse than justifying like a sloppy moral good. I get that point. But there's values in Jake Spoon's and explaining and understanding that. And that's why Lonesome Dove. I mean, the only reason I love Lonesome Dove is the characters. that is the thing of Lonesome Dove. Obviously, you have the pros,
the dialogue, description.
Yeah.
Brilliant. The plot was but thrilling.
It is that. Zooming in, and you know, one of Abercrombie's main inspirations is Lonesome Dove.
Let's backtrack a second. The only thing you loved about Lonesome Dove, you didn't love the plot, you didn't love the the thought provoking. Everything is a 5-star. It's a perfect novel.
Not the plot, but
yes, it is the plot.
No, it's a solid plot.
It's a perfect plot.
It's great.
It floored me.
Good. I'm glad. But what floored me, the characters are so unbelievably done. That is okay. Of all the things, what's the best part about the book?
Fine, fair enough. Characters.
Okay. So the characters in
better
the book.
Better put.
it does the tight focus on character. It does the moral ambiguity. It is honest. All these things so far, and it's your favorite book of all time.
Yeah.
So it is talking about that aspect. Then we have number four, which is sometimes life really is that shit, is what he says for number four. And how better to explain Lonesome Dove that sometimes life really is that shit.
Yeah.
Sometimes it really do.
Honestly, all the aspects that Joe's talking about are the things that I like about Lonesome Dove. Of sometimes
I'm trying to walk you into an agreement with this.
I do mostly agree with it. I'm just finding nuance, or else this video would be like 5 minutes long. Yeah, I agree. Sure. My favorite book of all time is
Lonesome
a
Dove.
Grim story, a story grit. Full of grit.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, no. But sometimes life really is that shit. Yeah, that's true. It just doesn't mean I want to read it all the time. But there's some value in it. Is there value in reading about, the shitty reality? Do you see a value in it?
The shitty reality?
Yeah, no, just our shitty reality of not glamming it up and showing the darker, just crappy, grimy side of life.
Yeah.
What value do you see in it?
Exactly what he's describing. It's an honest perspective. It is something that is true. And even if life, all stories too, even if it isn't true for you, others experience, and that's important to read. Again, done truthfully, done honestly. Because in my life, I haven't had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But is it valuable to read stories of people with cancer? Absolutely. So it's kind of in that same way. It's a truth. It's a perspective. And all that stuff's important. Yeah, I agree. Sometimes really life really is that shit. And no, I don't tend to read that all the time. It's not my go-to genre, but there's value to it. And he's talking to a lot of the, like he says, he does a straw man, but he's talking at the critics who are saying that not just, hey, they don't prefer it, but he's talking to critics that say it's wrong, reprehensible, morally, objectively morally wrong. Now, he gets to a point a little later where there's some nuance that I might slightly disagree with him, mm-hmm. but let's get into that. Because the next one, number five, I don't think it's this one, but number five, modernity.
Yes.
Modernity. Yeah, go ahead.
This one's just going into mainly the writing style of
mm-hmm.
Grimdark is often very modern prose, you know, using word, you know, instead of, you know, ye old English, it's, you know.
Doth thou wise hath just, been there thou.
Shit. Fuck. Damn it.
Like, wherest thus thy poo. Instead of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And his point is a pretty good one in the sense of Joe argues that your prose is meant to be, and when you write a book, it's supposed to be read today. And the people today read modern English. And if you're writing in English, if you're writing different language, writing in modern Spanish or German.
Wait.
Pick one.
Whoa. Okay, that's strange. He's writing. Wow. So don't kill the offbeat. It's like he's not writing this so that it could be read here and now in any future point. He's
every video.
No, everybody, we have to bring up the death of the author. By the way, if you don't know, we've had a 5-hour conversation on our Patreon. We had a video on the death of the author. Also, join our Patreon, link in the description below. This month is, what is it this month? Hyperion is this month's book club. So go ahead, join our Patreon. But yeah, Death of the Elf. I just had to slide it in there somewhere. So you're saying he's writing to modern somebody. Readers.
Yeah.
That's fascinating that he's writing to modern readers. Maybe readers 200
and wants
years
to be
from now.
Understood.
Oh.
And it's easier to be understood when you are using the language of the people you're writing to.
Yeah, okay, anyways.
But however,
we're also strong.
Yeah, so is he. Because ultimately, I also like prose that is trying to put you in a certain mood. It is trying to give you a good setting.
Mm-hmm.
Recent book I read, Goblin Emperor. A criticism can often be said about the book of the way it is written is often it's difficult because of how the, you know, the sentence structure, the pronoun situation with how names work and the conventions. Like, it's a complex writing style and can often be confusing. I think that adds so much to the world and gives a good way to set the setting. And it feels fantastical. So I think that's good, but it's certainly hard. It's easier to write in modern prose than to be understood in modern times. But move on to the next one, number six.
Yeah.
Shock value.
Shock value. And this is where we are jumping ahead into the Game of Thrones stuff.
A little
because
bit.
He says here, now clearly things are much more shocking when you're not used to them. The death of a certain main character in Game of Thrones blew my mind when I first read it. Now, central character death is rigor. Moral ambiguity, gore, and filth are common coin in fantasy to a degree. Certainly, they're not nearly as surprising as they were. But a well-executed scene can still have a mighty punch. And hey, as expectations change, you change it up. The vile mercenary saves a bunch of school kids. And he says, eventually, hey, he might even go and write something that's not so grit and grimdark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but shock value. What do you think about his whole point here with the value?
Yeah. So you can have internal shock value, and then also there's the cultural shock value. There, Grimdark had a lot more of a punch in when it was more of a budding subgenre, like the example he mentioned, because it was not done as much. Now it is, and so now you have to get more creative. You have to actually, you know, shock value requires, you know, expectations to be subverted. So now with how much Grimdark and, you know, death of a central character is more prominent when it happens, you can see it coming more often. So a great, but him going through at the very end there, you know, a vile mercenary saves a bunch of school kids. Grit allows more shock value. I would like to bring up an example. I feel like I can explore it just because it's so popular and well-known. I hope it's fine. I think Pirates of the Caribbean, the very first one, Curse of the Black Pearl, reason why Jack Sparrow is such a well-loved character is his grit. But it's the back and forth of you don't exactly know where he's not just a gritty, like grim character. He is a pirate, does not good things, clearly has killed people before. Like, yeah, gritty, but also he makes decisions where you go, oh, he does save some people sometimes, but he also robs them. He'll also kill these people, but he'll save this person. And it's back and forth, where you don't actually know what they're going to do. And that's what makes Jack a compelling character, is you don't know if he, like, you don't really know where his moral compass is. I think that's where shock value can be very fun, is like a gritty character where you don't exactly know what they're going to do. I think that is far more fun. And so specifically making the character gray rather than just black, because if you know they're a terrible character, it's not really shocking when they do terrible things.
That is when the grit can fail. He brings up way earlier of, if you just know by the prologue, hey, this one's going to end up eating babies. That's when it's kind of, if it becomes cliche and expected, and not necessarily that predicting something doesn't mean that it's bad storytelling. It's just that it can become, some things can become dry because you notice the pattern and archetype in such a way that it just feels contrived, or not contrived. It just feels lazy.
Yeah,
is maybe the better word.
You'll come across the big reveal scene, and it's hyped up. It's written in a way where it's supposed to be a big reveal. You can feel that the author is trying to surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you knew from like page 5 that it was going to happen, the scene really doesn't land. It's very different from like you knew it was going to happen and then it happens, but it's not really focused on. It's not dramatized. Like, it's not set up to be shocking. It's just a turning that you kind of expected. Far better.
It's the Hitchcock suspense, the bomb under the table. It's sure. The Sun Eater. Hey, I blew up the sun in book 7. I'm telling you that page 1 of book 1.
Yeah.
It's the suspense of, hey, I'm not going to be shocked that the sun explodes.
You spoiled book 7 of Sun Eater. Oh, no.
I did what you did earlier. Yeah, but you're not going to be shocked because he tells you book 1, page 1, I blew up a sun. So it's not that I'm going to go, oh, my God. Oh.
Yeah.
I almost spoiled something. It's not going to be that kind of shock. It's the suspense. It's the mulling in it. It's the journey part.
Yeah.
That is exciting. And so, yeah, the where the shock value can get really wrong is I can get annoyed by its intent is to be shocking and get you, but you're going, it's just shock for the sake of shock. That's where it can become just gratuitous for gratuitous sake. And you're like, okay, you're just...
Generally,
the twist becomes expected. That's what I hate the most, of when the twist tries to be clever, but it becomes expected because it's trying to subvert expectations so much that it's frustrating. The biggest, worst example of this, and he probably would have said it too if this came out later than 2013, but Game of Thrones Season 8 is so well known for how it was shock value. It was, hey, let's just throw some wrenches in this and speed up the plot. We don't have the books to rely on anymore. So how about, what if this whole thing we were building up, we just didn't do that? And
we subverted your expectations.
It was shocking. Yeah, shocking in a shit way. I'm saying that it's just an Abercrombie video. I feel like I have to curse more regularly, right? But that is where it's awful. Of you are subverting expectations for expectation's sake. We've said this a lot on the podcast, but to subvert expectations properly, it's one, was it built up in a way that twist makes sense? So first, the build up to it makes sense. And secondly, is that twist and the following story more interesting than had you not done that twist? That's just how to subvert an expectation. It's that easy. Well, it's very hard to do, but one, was it built up properly? And is that twist more interesting of a story going forward than not? And where shock value becomes so wrong and twisted is when, hey, by the way, it has the best story.
You're getting into spoiler territory, bud. You're getting to...
Yeah, Nick, just bleep the name, but it's fine. Everybody knows that, right? That's like Darth Vader's, Luke, I am your father.
Hey, you get on my case all the time.
That is a cultural phenom. How do we not... lightsabers exist.
Just like Jake Spoon.
Jake Spoon is not a phenom.
He's a cultural icon.
I wish. He's a fan... Well, he's a moral ambiguity, but he's great. And you get my point. It's the all the twists in season eight, for those who've seen it, it's just completely for shock value. The buildup makes no sense. It's so frustrating to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has a mighty punch, but a punch in the gut, not like a bad punch.
Yeah.
So that's where shock value can get real bad. But the shock value as a value, this of the seven, this is the one I probably disagree the most. Like maybe not even disagree, because I'm sure Abercrombie's on a similar page, but this is where I probably disagree the most, because the shock value as a value for Grit, right?
Ah.
Yeah. I think I don't value the shock incredibly. The thing that happens in book one with the shocking death that it talks about in Game of Thrones, I value that for, it was shocking, but I don't necessarily value it just because of the shock. I also value it because of
the story,
but what
was
it did
now,
to the story.
The story is now in a more interesting direction because of it. That's what's more important than the shock itself.
In a horror film, I don't value the jump scares. Like, a jump scare shocks me, but that's not the thing that necessarily sticks. It's what it does to the story, the themes, the impact on everything else. It's like the moment of shock isn't as valuable as the thematic and the resonance and what it does to, like,
everyone talks
the
about
genre
the
horror, itself. Yeah.
The horror story is the monster is always scariest before you actually see it. That the least scary horror stories is the one where the monster's like visible pretty early on. And you get one, basically. Like, the first time you see the monster is the most shocking, and everything after that is less in comparison. So, yeah, I value a horror story in so much that I do. I'm not a big horror guy. The ones I do is the atmosphere, the setup, and everything. And then you get the shock. It's good, but it's not nearly as good as everything else that came before it.
Yeah. But yeah, that's number six. And his last one is number seven, and it is range. He says it's another tool in the toolbox. That's what Grit is. And I think that as a main point is, I agree with it. Hey, Grit is another tool to use.
Yep. It could be used poorly. It could be used well. It is just another tool. Now, do you think that all tools have equal value?
No.
There you go. So is there a genre, is there a tool that is just not as valuable?
That's where he gets into talking about, I think after this, there's some quotes I want to bring up where he talks about the worthwhileness, how much worth and value does something have, right? Want to get into that?
Yep. Because, that's the thing that I probably disagree with the most.
So he says this. But grip and depth are not the same, comes the bleat. Cynicism isn't grown up. There's nothing clever about fart gags. He's talking about the cynics are saying this. It goes almost without saying that gritty writing at its worst is silly and superficial, just as tediously heroic and mannered writing at its worst is silly and superficial. Guess what? A lot of writing is silly and superficial, though obviously not mine at all. But the dividing line between what is righteous and worthwhile and what is wrongful and gratuitous is so fuzzy as to be a blur and will be in a totally different place, or indeed set of places, for every author and every reader. One person's disgracefully titillating torture porn can be another searing examination of how far one might go to get the truth. One person's foul profanity is another's hilarious and realistic dialogue. One person's perverse and unnecessary sex scene is another's honesty and necessary investigation of the full range of characters and their relationships. One person's disheartening pessimism that threatens the heart of Western civilization is another's thought-provoking deconstruction of conventions. He's just saying, hey, one man's trash is another person's treasure, essentially. And where this gets a little nuanced here is, I think what we were touching on earlier of like a missed moral point toward the negative is worse than the positive, right?
Yeah.
You're saying that. But there's certainly value to it, but I think it's more of a, can be more dangerous. Maybe that's the wrong word, but okay, use this example. Taxi Driver, for example, right? Use that versus a Pixar film. Maybe I'm using a poor example here, but these are just things we talked about this episode. But Taxi Driver, although the intent and the movie itself said, hey, we're not propping up Travis's character as a morally good person. However, a viewer that watched that, it was John Hinckley Jr., watched that film, was emboldened by it, became obsessed with Jodie Foster, and went to shoot the president, President Reagan, to fall in love with Jodie Foster. It was inspired by the film to do so. This is not to say that Grimdark does this stuff or Grit does it. That is the person's fault. That is the psycho's fault. That is not the the artist's fault at all.
Same thing with Stephen King's book, Rage.
Yeah.
Basically, not just inspired one school shooter, but I believe like three or four before the book, like Stephen King himself pulled the book from publication. Of not that like, oh, they happened to find out that this person read the book at some point. Some directly referenced it as their inspiration. Others like had the books and reenacted the book almost scene for scene and copied the book in real life. And like, that's
how much responsibility like, does the
three,
author have?
Three, four times is like, that's a lot. That's a surprising amount for a book. That's a lot of inspirations for school shootings. That's not a one-off.
How much responsibility would you say the author has?
Ultimately, responsibility? None. It falls on the individual who does commit the acts. Like, they are responsible. I wouldn't blame Stephen King for the deaths of children. But it certainly means that you got to be careful. You got to be careful with what you write sometimes. Of like, it could be taken wrong ways and, you know, a poor moral message can have consequences for, you know, wider society. If the culture is just chock full of pessimistic moral messaging, of hypercriticism of even very standard morally good things, like, what do you think that's going to do to people? I wouldn't imagine anything particularly good. It's fine to have criticism and the critiques of all this stuff, but if that's all you're doing, can get pretty grim, depressing.
And this is the argument he makes. This was a quote that really stuck out for me. If a movement is worthless, it will quickly dry up. If a movement is valuable, it will influence what comes after. This is why I always raise an urbane eyebrow when people go beyond declaring something bad and into the arena of proclaiming it wrong. That statement there, like, if a movement is worthless, it will quickly dry up. Valuable movements will influence what comes after. And he's pushing against what people say. It's not just bad, but it's wrong. And talk about the grit, the grimdark genre.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Now, is it a straw man to say that, hey, look, there's been plenty of bad movements. I certainly can be a judge. I can judge some movements in history.
I can name one and a half.
Bad. I can name at least one. Maybe even two movements that were not particularly great. And were very influential. It didn't go away real quick. They stuck for a little while.
Mm.
So, to some degree.
Is that what he's saying, right?
Is that what he's saying? Is he talking about these, you know, grand, you know, political movements or ethnic cleansing is the same as writing, you know, sex scenes and bloody violence in books? It's not what he's saying. I don't think he's trying to conflate it, but...
Why that... sorry, go ahead.
But no, it is this point of it being just another tool and that it's valuable because it's, you know, popular. That's just the thing I disagree with. Not everything that's popular is good at all.
Yeah, I'd be curious because here's where I would need to know the intent of the author, right? Of Joe Abercrombie, where it's interesting because how do you take the word worthless? What do you mean by the word valuable? Right? Mm-hmm. That means there's more ambiguity to what that word means. So I would like asking Abercrombie, for example, he's saying if a movement's worthless, like if your value of worth is that people pay attention to it and follow it, it's worthwhile because it is what literary movement in this sense, it's worthwhile because people admire it, read it, and it influences, and is that valuable, right? But is he talking about like when people call something bad or wrong as a literary movement? Because I'm trying not to extend that to obvious, like the obvious point of there's movements you can talk about going, hey, I think that's a naughty. I think that's probably not good. But in the sense he's saying that I was trying to think of some literary movements that I'd say are just bad. We talk about modern art all the time, the squares. I'm like,
yeah.
All right. It's valued to people, right? I get that it is valued. Modern
brutalist architecture.
The film, The Brutalist, sucks.
Brutalist architecture.
Pretentious movie.
is wrong. Not just ugly. It's wrong. It's evil. It's a great evil
blot
on ours.
That's exactly what he's talking about.
Oh, no. I'm hardcore. Brutalist architecture has no value. It is worthless. It is evil. It must be eradicated from all architecture schools.
Pretty brutal.
I hate it. I want it to die. There should be laws about it. Needs to go away.
Exactly what he's talking about here is that if a movement's worthless,
I want my fancy McDonald's back with the bright lights and the fun. I'm tired of these gray walls.
What kind of America do we live in where McDonald's don't have columns and like it's
the golden arches need to come back. Mm. We need to bring it back.
Why does it look like the Pantheon? Why?
Oh, God, remember when Pizza Hut was cool and fun?
I haven't had pizza in a long time.
Remember when you were a kid and you got to eat fun things?
Yeah, yeah.
That Pizza Hut was cool.
Is it gone now?
It's gone.
What?
It's back down to being just a sad gray building that shares its space with a Taco Bell.
That was a pretty gritty description.
It's gritty. I hate it. I hate it so much.
But it's honest.
It's reality, and reality does not need... We get to choose our reality. We can deem it to be something
else. So we've chosen a grimdark reality.
We have chosen this. It is not set in stone. We may aspire to greater things. We can grow beyond the combo Taco Bell and Pizza Hut.
Combo Taco Bell.
We can aspire to greater things as a people.
Don't even change the food, just the aesthetics. That's all we're asking.
Keep the food the same. It's not.
The food will taste better if things look prettier. Like if I'm eating a sandwich, but I'm looking at a beautiful piece of art, that sandwich becomes infinitely better.
It does.
If I'm eating a sandwich in an alley and it's gross and I can smell shit, it's worse.
You understand of like how much your food can improve as far as cooking. Is if you just add color on top of whatever you're making. If you have a rice dish and you just add a few little tiny pieces of green onion.
I was going to say
that
the
does
same
not,
thing.
That little tiny piece of green onion on top of your bowl of rice doesn't add much flavor at all. But that little bit of color adds so much flavor when you actually eat it and look at it. It is so much better than just your rice. Aesthetics are important. Beyond this, we're getting back to literature.
I kind of like the green onion. That was great.
I'm far more passionate about brutalist architecture than I am about many things, surprisingly. But I think a similar vein can fall into grimdark. Is grimdark can go to a certain point where I'd rather it go the other direction. And as far as a cultural touchstone, point. I don't think a culture mired in grimdark is particularly healthy or good. But that doesn't mean the genre itself is worthless. Is that understandable? Like when I'm noticing every piece, like so much art is like the point is to be grimdark, brutal, morally gray, and like that's everything. I would say that's not particularly good. That seems to be emblematic of unhealthy society, people who are not generally okay.
Well, that is what he says here. I'll repeat again. He says, if a movement's worthless, it will quickly dry up. If a movement is valuable, it will influence what comes after. So again, it comes to the terms. What does he mean by worthless and valuable? And when he's saying for grimdark, when people declare something bad or wrong, that's when it kind of gets into that territory. For example, when you hear romanticy and it's like, hey, that's bad, wrong. Like you can hear that a lot. The fantasy genre was seen as bad and wrong a while ago. Just
sure.
from public because like, look at that fantasy fiction and all that. Look at those video games that you're playing with shoot 'em up games. Like today, what we would say is acceptable could have been too far 20 years ago far.
Of course.
And 40 years ago. Right. So, what he's talking about, this fuzzy gray line of what is acceptable and what's not, I do get it, and it makes sense of
the fuzziness of a line doesn't, I think, deny that there is any line at all. Like, just because it's the same point of previously, just because there's moral ambiguity doesn't mean there, like, everything, like, there's nothing that's morally good or bad. That's, I think, the distinction, like, just because things are murky and hazy sometimes doesn't deny that existence at all.
It's when you get to the things that are more morally ambiguous, that when you touch on that honesty, that reality of, hey, explaining, not justifying, all the things we talked about in this episode, it's the question of it, mainly the statement that if the movement's valuable, influence of what comes after, of it is value, is something valuable just because a lot of people admire it, or a lot of people support it, or a lot of, basically majority rule of, if it's utilitarian in the aspect of, hey, a lot of people value it and it influences things, does that make it, that means it can't be wrong or bad? I don't know if that's exactly what it's saying. I need to read into it more, but I wouldn't say that just because
something's popular doesn't mean it's good.
Yeah, just because a movement happens and its value doesn't mean like it has an inherent goodness. It inherently, I guess, in the way it's worthwhile in the sense that it does affect change, and it's a part of literary movements. It's a part of who we are as a society, and so in that sense, it is. But does that mean, like, I guess, again, using the terms bad or wrong or good, what do you mean by that? Because I would say a movement that you're referring to would be bad and wrong.
Yes.
Or there's certain, I can name films and books that, like,
bad
that
message.
I am morally opposed to. Like,
yeah.
I'm morally opposed to, like, I won't even go and list some of the things, but like anything where children are depicted and it's called like cinema, like Cuties and stuff like that.
That's pretty.
No, I don't want to like focus on bad stuff like that, because there's things I would be like, no, I have a line for sure that I would say is wrong and bad. Now, is grit and grimdark bad, wrong, immoral? When it justifies being like, hey, look at this person who we should embolden and you should go also kill people. That's where it's bad and wrong. But if
very often I would give the author charity in the sense it's probably not the author like supporting whatever evil, terrible thing. It's more the skill of the writer and the misinterpretation from a reader, because, you know, people have their own preconceived notions and can bring whatever their thoughts into a book and take the completely wrong message out of it. Completely possible. So very, very, very often won't really blame the writer for it. It's just the end results being potentially negative.
Yeah, and I get it. What was it called? The TPP or something like that? Like the woman that organized against the like video game violence, and thinking that was attributed to to children and violence and school shootings and all the sorts. But it's a difficult, again, blurry lines, fuzzy. There is a line for people out there, and for you to call something wrong, just where moral ambiguity is good in this kind of literature is where it makes you think and reconsider your preconceived notions, and that stuff can be interesting to read about. This is kind of going, we're kind of like diving into just more general stuff than just literary as well. It just brought those thoughts. Again, hey, it made me think a lot about, what do I declare as bad or wrong? And for example, talking about the first law books and what Joe Abercrombie does, none of that's wrong. None of that's bad. All of this is like interesting stuff. Know my thoughts on the first law series, but I thought it was fascinating characters with a more, like, when it came to the thought-provoking nature, just, okay. I get it. And it didn't like teach anything bad. It was just more like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, it's an honest perspective of the world. And
one would say just more cynical.
Yeah, it's fine. And yeah, I guess that was some big takeaways there of, he has two more paragraphs that toward the end of this essay, one of them being George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire, surely the gold standard of gritty epic fantasy, is also rapidly becoming the most successful epic fantasy of this era. In due course, I don't doubt the pendulum will swing back at least some of the way towards romantic and heroic. So he does admit that hey, the pendulum's going to swing of, what are people getting more sick of? What are the archetypes? What are the cliches? Let's get something new and fresh, because we yearn for something that is innovative.
Yeah,
quote unquote original,
right? Or at the very least, just not familiar.
Exactly, and we've gone through pattern time and time again. I'm of the opinion any moral philosophical thing you could possibly think of, they've talked about it for hundreds, thousands of years ago. Just everything happened just in the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. Just out from there, basically look at China, look at Greece, and look at the Middle East. Everything was talked about at some point in one of three locations long ago, and we're just repeating things now. And maybe give Shakespeare some credit too. And then we're just repeating things over and over again, and it'll just keep swinging back and forth, back and forth.
True.
In conclusion, Joe Abercrombie says, so yeah, shitty, gritty books are no better than shitty, shiny books, but I proudly and unapologetically assert that there's a great deal more to grit than a capacity to shock and titillate. Although I must equally, proudly, and unapologetically assert that I do sometimes enjoy being shocked and titillated.
Fair enough.
Fair enough, Joe. And that anything that you took away big time from this discussion? Did you like the article overall? I think it sparked a lot of great discussion.
I did. The ultimate thing I got from this one is Joe really likes to be titillated.
He likes titties.
Oh. Probably.
Is that allowed?
I think so.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it's gritty.
Yeah, sure.
Hey.
It's true. It's honest.
It's honest. It's real.
It's nasty, what's dirty
what's
stuff.
Something shocking you could say to the viewer that would just get them boom titillated?
Well,
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.